I couldn't like stop him from sliding more. I tried to arrest and then arrest and arrest. It turned out we ended up tumbling down like 1,000 or 1,500 feet.
Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. I am Dr. Sarah Spelsberg, and I am your host for this edition, retired USAF pararescueman and flight paramedic with Guardian Flight Alaska. Our guest tonight is paramedic John Davis, and in this installment, we are going to discuss the differences in military and civilian rescue operations, how the two can merge and collaborate, and some of the extreme tasks paramedics undertake to reach their patients in remote Alaska. So I'm joined by paramedic John Davis. He was a United States Air Force combat controller for 6 years, a United States Air Force pararescueman for 15 years, firefighter paramedic with Anchorage Fire Department for 8 years, and a flight paramedic with Guardian, which is one of the commercial medevac operators in Alaska for 1 year. And so, John Davis, thank you very much for joining me today. Welcome to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
And so when you were young, what did you picture as a career when you got older? Because your career has become a very interesting portfolio beast. And so what were you picturing when you were little?
my mom was a nurse. She was an RN. And that being part of my life was a big thing. And she always talked about how helping people was a big part of her life and what made her happy. And so I kind of started going down that road with Boy Scouts and my first aid merit badge and then lifeguard merit badge. And then I became a surf lifeguard in Rhode Island on the ocean. And then just kind of, I don't know how it all happened. I don't know what took me to the recruiter's office, but then ended up joining the military. And then there was a little hiatus with taking care of people. And that's when I was a combat controller for those 6 years.
And that's incredible. So you joined the Air Force right out of high school, active duty. And so you're not, do you remember what inspired this decision?
Yeah, no, it's kind of bizarre. It was really weird. I do remember asking, I had applied to colleges and was ready to do that. But like down deep, I didn't think I was ready to do it. I didn't think I was mature enough to go and take that step and waste money. And I was like, for some weird reason, I just asked a friend to take me to the recruiter's office. Didn't tell my mom or dad or anything. And they told me that I had a guaranteed job and to be a physical therapy assistant. And turns out that wasn't the case. When I got to basic training, they said, you can choose from this list of jobs. And I was like, I don't want to do any of those jobs. The recruiter told me I had this other job. So, So back to your question, I'm not sure what took me there. I do have a long line of military people in my family. My dad was in Vietnam.
Sure.
My brother is actually a 2-star general in the Army now. There's a lot of military in my family. It seemed like a secure stepping stone for me.
Yes. And so straight out of the gates, pretty much, you end up hucking yourself out of airplanes into austere environments and setting up what is arguably, I think, one of the most important assets in any wartime or disaster situation, and that's communications. Is that correct?
That's right, Sarah. Command and control is a humongous thing. And then, of course, getting these assets and the people to the battlefield in a quick and expedient way. And you do that by setting up airfields and jumping out of planes and doing things like that. And controlling air traffic coming to those dirt strips all around.
Wow. So would you jump out of the plane with all of your equipment too? Or would equipment land separately?
Yep, we would always have equipment that we carry, like it was a rucksack that we would attach to our harness, whether we were free falling or doing static line jumps. Either way. And of course, our rifles. But as far as the big equipment that we would use, we would airdrop that. We would actually airdrop motorcycles, and we would land next to the motorcycle package and go and derig the motorcycles, start them up, and go and clear the runway, set the runway up at nighttime on MVGs to then bring in the air land package.
Wow. And so this is, I mean, these have to be some pretty austere, extreme places. And so, what kinds of places and climates did you jump into? Did you kind of have to be ready for anything? Jungle, Arctic, desert?
Yes, all the above. However, when I was a combat controller, none of the wars were going on. And so I was a combat controller during peacetime. And so it was all just training. So we would go and do training all around the world. I was stationed in Japan for a while, so we would go to do it all over Southeast Asia and Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Australia, Guam, and the Micronesia chain in there. But yeah, we would do a lot of practice all around there for sure.
And so when in all of this did you become a paramedic?
So I had a 6-year enlistment with the active duty Air Force that I had to fulfill. And I knew kind of right away that the active duty Air Force wasn't for me. I started to learn that calling in airstrikes and doing things like that wasn't part of who I am down deep. I'd rather help people. So I separated from the active duty Air Force and went directly into the Air National Guard as a full-time guardsman. And they sent me to the Joint Special Operations Combat Medic course in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. At the time, there was a joint push to get all of the medics in the special operations world trained the same way at the same place. And so that went on. That school was alive for a few years, but then everyone decided to go their separate ways. I thought it was a great opportunity. So that's where I got my paramedic. And then they sent me to pararescue school in Kirtland Air Force Base, Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then you spend a year and a half there doing all different types of things.
Did you volunteer for this, or were you voluntold for this?
No, I volunteered for it. And I volunteered for it with the auspice that I was going to be stationed here in Alaska to do, because I knew that this team here did a lot of civilian rescue. And they did a lot of, they did trips on Denali and did rescue with the, National Park Service climbing rangers. So it was a kind of an environment that I'm interested in that I always like to climb and be outdoors and such.
That's great. Yeah. And so how much time did you spend on Denali?
I've been up there 3 times, and each time you're going on patrol, you're there for a month. And you start at 7,000 at base camp, and you go up when you're on a patrol, then you make your way up to the advanced base camp at 14,000 feet. And the Park Service flies in a whole bunch of stuff, including food and propane and heaters and tents, and to kind of base their higher altitude rescue situation.
And then in the middle of all this, did you end up deployed again?
Yeah. So every once 2000, September 11th, happened, I'd say that we were deployed every 18 months. And we would typically have a chunk of 4 months at a time for those deployments every 18 months, if that makes sense. So mm-hmm. You may not go on the mountain or on Denali for a year or two, and then you'll come back and you'll just roll back in there if that's something that you wanted to do. It's something I like to do.
Oh, I think it sounds amazing. Did you ever feel in your time on Denali, did you ever feel like I might end up needing rescue up here because either the weather went south, or I know it's a very technical mountain.
Yeah. You know, I can say that I didn't feel that way. Because if you have the proper training and equipment, and you know how to conduct yourself, it's at the end of the day, it's all very basic. It's just kind of doing things to stay alive. And whether if your tent gets torn apart in the wind, then you just dig a hole in the snow and live in a snow cave until the storm subsides. Like, you, and then you just keep on digging the hole out so you don't suffocate in there. But I don't think I've felt that way. One particular time on Denali, we were coming back down from the summit, and there was one section that goes from Denali Pass back to the 17,000 foot camp. And my partner, and it's called the Autobahn, and it's called the Autobahn because a lot of people fall on it. It's a long side hill, and people fall and slide, and die and get hurt. So on our way back down this one particular day, my partner fell, and I couldn't arrest him. I couldn't like stop him from sliding more. I tried to arrest and then arrest and arrest. It turned out we ended up tumbling down like 1,000 or 1,500 feet with no incident. But I mean, maybe that was a time when I thought that might be it, but it worked out.
In the moment of that, that would have felt like a pretty dire situation to me. But yeah. It sounds like you guys slid down and slid it out together and came out without injury. Oh, that's, well, I'm glad you both came out without injuries. So you're on Denali, you're deploying to presumably dry desert climates. Afghanistan. And, you know, were you parajumping over there too? You were a paramedic?
Yeah. So our main mission as pararescuemen is to be there for our air crew members if they get shot down, whether it's jets, fighter jets, or C-130s or other helicopters or whatever. And to recover DOD assets. And that's the main mission. However, unlike Vietnam, our adversary weren't shooting down a lot of planes, and we weren't crashing a lot of planes. There were, however, a lot of people getting severely injured, blown up, shot up on the ground. So we kind of morphed into doing a lot of medevac. And I think what would happen typically is our helicopters and our helicopter crews and our helicopters have guns mounted on them. And so oftentimes when the Army's was called to do a medevac and it was too high a risk for them, we would go in because we have guns and we can fight our way in and fight our way out of a landing zone or a hoist zone or something like that. Turned out to be our primary situation over there, whether it's extricating people from Humvees or those big vehicles that you've seen, then they get blown up. And then of course, doing all the medical care that's needed to, and then en route back to the base. And then, on occasion you would get farmed out to, Army Special Forces team and be attached to them as their medic and embedded SAR person. Or SEAL teams, either way, if they were down a medic or whatever. So
was it difficult to sort of attach to a team that's been working together for presumably months to years and fit into their flow, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think oftentimes it comes down to the personality of who's going to be going and be attached to that team. And each team, oftentimes they have strong cohesion and they don't like outsiders. But I can say that we were always welcomed because their medics were tired of doing that work. And additionally, I think the first few deployments that I went on in Afghanistan, when I would get attached to an SF team, I knew the medics because I had gone through school with them in Fort Bragg. So it was kind of like a reunification, and they were psyched to see me, and I was psyched to see them, and we'd go do our business.
I love that. Yeah. Now, something I try to touch on, and that's sometimes a difficult topic for some people, it seems like it's a easier topic to talk to broach more recently, but and it affects a lot of people in the military and SAR and extreme medicine. And what are, I mean, you've obviously been in some pretty intense situations. So what are some of the coping skills you've learned to employ to balance your life and to avoid a traumatic stress injury?
I don't know that you can avoid the injury. I think that that's just inherent in the business. But I guess my answer to Sarah is very basically, you just don't choose things that are destructive in your life or just destructive in general, like drinking or using drugs or things like that. Staying healthy, talking about it, seeking help when things become overwhelming, if they become overwhelming, from professionals that have experience with people that have severe trauma.
I love that answer.
Yeah.
That is perfect. It's very similar to, I interviewed another, a person who deployed with both the Australian and the US armies, and they had a very similar answer. It was whatever your coping mechanisms are, make sure they're not destructive. And right. I think that's really good advice. And I like it that people are talking about it more too. My SAR team, even back in the 90s, we had to debrief. They made us. And sometimes we debriefed with a counselor if it was a really intense rescue or if it was someone we all knew, which often it was. And I think that those habits set me up for life with how to deal with the things that we see.
Absolutely. You know, interestingly enough, a friend of mine is a social worker that works for the VA, and he does a lot of telehealth stuff with people that live in Western Oregon in kind of remote areas where there aren't a lot of services for these vets. And he put out a clinic one weekend. It was a 2-day situation just to talking about PTSD, signs and symptoms, and how to deal with it all. And during one of the breaks, I asked him how, and this was maybe 10 years ago now, but I asked him how many people from Iraq and Afghanistan he's dealing with. He's like, yeah, you could imagine we're dealing with some. He says, but really we're dealing with people from Vietnam because they came home from the war. They got a job. They busied themselves with their new families and lives, and now they're retired. And when they retire, they don't have anything to occupy their brains. So I think that's a really important thing for people to consider. We all want to stay busy. That's kind of what we do. But just keeping tabs on what kind of history you have with that trauma is important, not to just let it stay buried.
Yes. And I think we kind of failed our Vietnam vets.
Yeah.
In so many ways.
And I think another point, I'm sorry to keep going on about this, but another point is at that Joint Special Operations Medical School that I went to, I think we had a day or a whole day or possibly two whole days of training that revolved around that, which is important. And I do think that the military is attending to those things.
I feel like it's a easier conversation to have. And you know, when we did a Special Forces critical care course for the military, we hosted at Mayo, and it came up a lot. And these guys were very open about it, and they're very open about how they coped and you know what they were trying. You know, what they thought worked for them. And I was really proud because I'm like, this is the way out for them. This is the path to a normal life. And I'm just really proud of the emotional growth and the maturity that they displayed. And I love it that's a normal conversation to have now for you all. And so you separated from active duty and you joined full-time Air National Guard in Alaska. You're in peacetime during your active duty, and now you're in the Air National Guard and you're deploying to wartime. And so with civilian search and rescue, I mean, you did this for 15 years and a lot happened in Alaska over this time period. Like climbing on Denali really became more and more popular and more crowded. And I think the guiding companies made it possible for people who maybe normally wouldn't be able to climb a mountain like that, and made it easier for less skilled climbers to attempt large peaks. So you've had a couple of interesting things happen on Denali, and I didn't have enough time to look up what's the highest crike ever performed in the world, but tell me a little bit about a crike that was performed at quite a high altitude on Denali.
Yeah, that was a good friend of mine, Bobby Schnell. It was another person that had fallen on the Autobahn, and one thing led to another, and he couldn't continue to secure his airway, and they didn't have the equipment to intubate, you know, laryngoscope or anything, you know what I mean? And so they cracked him and ended up being the life-saving procedure for this person.
And it's not a common procedure in a tent.
Yeah. In a tent at 17,000 feet where your oxygen saturations just normally are in the 60s, let alone having an injury.
You have an injury, you're cold, all of the bad, and you're at altitude, all the bad things to happen together. So he saved this person's life with a cricothyrotomy at 17,000 feet.
He did. And I think he sat at him for a couple of days before they were able to fly the helicopter up there.
That's some serious prolonged field care.
Yeah.
And managing it for days. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a procedure that there are ER docs who have probably never done one because they've never had to. That's really good for him. Right. You should be very proud of that.
Yeah, right place, right time. There's a whole litany of stories of all types of rescues that have gone on up there there's a lot of stuff that happens, as you can imagine.
There is, and stuff that could happen to anybody. You know, several of my friends have been caught in avalanches or different things. It's like that they did nothing wrong other than being there. The weather was acceptable, the snowpack was acceptable. It's just really bad luck sometimes. Sometimes it's not a mistake other than simply being there.
Absolutely.
So how high up Denali do bears go?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm trying to think. I think that a bear got into a cache. I'll have to reconfirm and get back with you on the exact altitude, but I think that 11,000 feet, a bear got into a cache. But
Alaska's get
back with you on that.
Of course. No worries. And Alaska's known for bear maulings. So how often do you and your paramedic parajumper colleagues have to respond to scenes like this? I mean, it's not a thing that happens all the time, but I always feel like we had a few a year.
Yeah, it's not something that happens all the time. I would say that there's been approximately five calls, missions that the 212th and 210th have responded to that were bear maulings. Yep.
And how often are they survived?
Yeah, I was going to say it's maybe half of them. Yeah. Yeah. They're pretty grisly and gruesome.
Literally grisly and definitely gruesome. So what kind of bear protection do you take with you?
I've spent a lot of time in this state walking and traveling for fun. And generally I just bring bear spray. I mean, I've walked thousands and thousands of miles all over the state, and bear spray is all I take. I don't subscribe.
Have you ever had to deploy it?
No, I've had to take it out though. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've been charged a couple times, but they're usually bluffs and they tend to go on their way. Oftentimes they're scared of you. When the times that they're aggressive, I believe they're with it's a mom with their cubs. or they're sitting, or the animal is sitting on a dead kill.
And they're afraid you're going to take it.
Yeah. So back to the bear spray. The bear spray is shown to be more effective than a gun. It has a wider berth of, it's a spray. And when you're being attacked like that, how do you know you're going to have the wherewithal to do the right thing with that gun? That's my two cents on that. Someone that's shot a metric ton of bullets in training and in combat, I believe in that bear spray.
I've always heard that a gun might just make the bear mad.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah. I mean, I think that there are people that are definitely successful with the gun with bears. There's no doubt.
Is there any, do you have any advice for people adventuring out in Alaska and other places where there are bears for like avoiding the bears or for getting the bear to stand down?
Yeah. So avoiding them, like I said, oftentimes they don't want to be around you. They're when you're in these remote places of Alaska, they're not used to seeing people. So if you're noisy and they're going to hear you and they're going to be gone before you even come close to them. So being noisy, always talking, you know, a lot of people that go do solo trips and they'll sing songs all the time. And some people carry bells. That's controversial if that really works or not.
So you were stationed up on Denali, back to Denali. You were stationed up there for a month at a time. And has it ever felt like a mass casualty incident where you feel like you have more patience than you or your team can handle?
Yeah, I haven't. We had one, back to the story that my partner and I went for a ride down the Autobahn. It was a couple days before that trip that we took up to the top. We had two climbers that fell from Denali Pass. There were two Spanish climbers that fell from Denali Pass, and they were both incapacitated, incoherent, unconscious, GCS of 4, 5, somewhere in there for both of them. And by the time, so we had gone to bed this one particular evening, and one of the guide concessions up there, they came and knocked on the tent, and I said, we see some dots way out in the Peters at the base of the Autobahn. And so we got out and we looked over there with the binoculars, and sure enough, there are two people. So my partner, Tucker Chenoweth, who is the head climbing ranger in the South District climbing range, or South District Ranger for Denali National Park now, he and I walked out there, assessed the first person. He seemed the worst. The other guy was trying to get to his feet and couldn't talk. The first guy had severe head trauma. Both boots were ripped off, both gloves were ripped off. They had been out there for a while, so they had frostbitten hands and feet. Then we moved on, we left him, went to the second guy to assess him, and Tucker and I were able to kind of pick him up and carry him together, which was, I don't know, maybe a mile back to our camp. I'd have to go on the map and really look. It seemed like a long time because it's 17,000 feet. 17,000 feet on Denali feels much different than 17,000 feet on Everest because of where you are in latitude. I'm sure you know that. Mm-hmm. So 17,000 feet on Denali feels more probably like 19,000 on Everest. So back to that story. So we carried him back. While we're doing that, another one of our team set up a tent that was going to be our medical tent because we had to put them somewhere. And then we drug a sled back out and put this other guy in the sled and drug him back. And then we have very limited capability up there, as we talked about earlier. So I drained all the oxygen that we had. We just continued to keep them warm, rewarm them. With hot water bottles, recycling them throughout the night. And And that's it. They were both multi-system trauma, broken ribs, broken spines, broken necks, head trauma. Pneumos. I think I did dart one of them. Yeah. Anyway.
Wow. And so how many days how long did you have them with you up there?
So that happened. I think we got them back to the tent around midnight, and we weren't able to get a helicopter up there until noon the next day, I think. So through the night, but maybe 16, 18 hours, 18 hours. Yeah.
How do you heat up water bottles up there?
Oh, just boil water with your stove.
Okay. Yeah.
Boil water and then just keep doing that. Keep heating them up. Put them in the sleeping bags. I think we were recycling, each person had six per bag. And we just keep on recycling.
Okay. I like that idea. Everyone take note. Boil water in hot water bottles helps warm people. It's a good way to keep people warm.
Yeah, and the only stove that works at altitude like that is the XGK, the MSR XGK. Whisper lights don't work.
MSR XGK. Okay. Yeah. We're going to put that in the notes also, the MSR XGK.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the only stove that works up there.
Maybe there are some others, but that is the tried and true. It's very simple.
Okay.
It just puts out a lot of B2s. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That's a good, that's really good advice. So now when you jump, are you jumping from a C-130, from another type of fixed wing, from a helicopter?
Generally speaking, if it's jumping for work and for the mission, we're going to jump from a C-130. We do jump from helicopters. We'll jump from anything for training. We go to civilian drop zones and do a lot of training from civilian aircraft.
How high is this C-130 when you jump out of it?
It depends. It depends on what you're doing. If whether you're going to be doing something in combat in a free fall situation, you're going to be quite high and you're going to be wearing an oxygen mask more than likely. If you're going to be doing like a mass attack kind of thing with a static line situation in combat, it's going to be low, 800 to 1,000 feet. That's a static line situation. Okay. And up here in Alaska, when we would use parachuting for a mission, for instance, if we were to jump into the water, say there's someone with a esophageal varices on a ship way out 500 miles south of Adak, we'll fly down there in the C-130. We have Zodiac boats that are rigged into these bundles. They're deflated and S-folded on top of itself. The engine's already attached to it. We have a compressed air tank that's attached to it as well. We push that out of the back of the plane and we skydive out after it. And then we land next to it in the water. We pop two buckles and then crack the tank and it inflates the boat. We dewater the engine and then motor over to the ship or the sailboat or whatever it is. We do that. We have jet skis that we drop are the same idea. So that's one type of jumping that is performed by the rescue triad here in Alaska and throughout the DOD. Then we also have static line square. We have static line round parachutes, which allow us to jump at a lower altitude. Like I said, 800 feet or maybe a little bit lower. There isn't much, they're not very steerable. So you're relying on the spot that you get with the wind drift indicators. And then we also do static line square, and then you can increase the altitude a little bit. And we now have a steerable parachute, very similar to smoke jumpers. And we'll have that parachute and we can steer right down to the ground and land right where you want to land.
So what kind of gear are you wearing when you're jumping into the Bering Sea? I mean, it's the temperature of melted ice. Are you wearing like a wetsuit, a dry suit?
Yeah, dry suits. Yep. Dry suits and all the, okay. You dress for the occasion,
Yes.
Yep.
Oh.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then one of these times, so for those that know, the Anchorage International Airport, it's called the Ted Stevens International Airport. And he was a beloved senator in Alaska, and his plane went down in 2010. And you were one of the early responders to this, what I can only imagine was a horrific scene. And yeah. So tell me a little bit about what it was like to respond to a commercial aircraft in remote Alaska.
So to back up a little bit, explain a little bit more, the general aviation is a big deal here in Alaska, and there are lots of little planes that are flying around, whether they're personally owned or owned by a lodge or whatever. And mm-hmm. and the 176th wing, which is the pararescue men, the helicopters and the C-130s and all the maintenance people, they respond to numerous aircraft crashes every year. For one reason or another, these planes are crashing. So what was it like? So we've been waiting for 3 days. We've been waiting to get to another airplane crash on the Kinnick Glacier, which is just outside of Anchorage here. And we would just go and sit in the helicopter. We would go fly the helicopter to the cloud line on that glacier and land and sit and then watch the clouds. And if the clouds were to lift, we're going to race in there and get the four people that were stuck inside this fuselage on this glacier. And so we were sitting there waiting to do that. And then we get called for another mission, which is what you're talking about with Senator Stevens and that plane crash. So we left there, and that happens to be in Western Alaska. And the route to get to Western Alaska in a helicopter is one of four passes. And we try going through each one of these passes, and finally we found one of the passes passable. The weather was just too bad everywhere. So we finally went around, and it required a lot of, I think we had to air refuel twice just to make all of this happen with our helicopters getting gas from our C-130s. And then we made it to Dillingham. And less than ideal, less than minimum weather, landed, took a nap for a few hours and waited for the sun to come up, and then went out to the site. And my partner and I, Chris Abel, got hoisted down with our equipment, which included a couple med packs and a backpack that had extrication equipment that we would kind of tear into a plane to make bigger holes to move people in and out of them. And then we also went down with a Stokes litter, backboard, some other equipment. And then we kind of got in there and started getting to work. Earlier in the evening before, a helicopter had brought in a pediatric intensivist who happened to be in Dillingham. So she was able to get in there and had a little bit of pain medication that she could give to the people. And she sat in that plane and that wreckage all evening with an EMT that was there as well. So we get there, took stock of what was going on, and came up with a plan. My partner, Chris, who is now a PA, he's a great guy. He went in and started to stabilize, deal with the pain stuff so we could move these people and immobilize them so we could move them without injuring them anymore, while I kind of coordinated the next steps of air using the helicopters and what we're going to do next. And as well as cutting a big hole in the back of the plane that we could move these people that needed to be immobilized along board. And so that extrication gear gets to use. All while we're doing this, because it's such a high visibility situation with Senator Stevens, they threw a lot of resources at it. And the Coast Guard showed up, and a rescue swimmer came down and helped us out moving patients out of the plane and then over to an area that that we were hoisting from. And then we loaded two patients on his helicopter, the least critical, because he's trained to an EMT level. And then so he left, went back to Dillingham. Our helicopter came in and we loaded two more patients with our helicopter, and Chris went back with them. And then they came back, and I think we did one more load to get the rest of the survivors out. And then we another helicopter crew from our helicopter squadron was flown out in the C-130. They then got on the helicopter because we had been up all night. Our pilots had been up all night, and they went out and recovered the deceased. So,
well, that just sounds like a horrific scene. And I just think you're all heroes for going into those situations. And, you know, we always say look for the helpers, and
you're doing our job.
Definitely a look. It's a job, but it's look for the helpers. And whatever happened to the people on the glacier?
Oh, yeah. So
they pulled you off of.
Yeah, the saga goes on. So we get on the C-130 and fly back with the patients and the deceased. And when we land at Elmendorf Air Force Base, J-Bear, right when we landed, the Army guard, they tried to get in there. They saw a little bit of a break in the weather. They tried getting in there and they crashed their helicopter. No one was injured. Okay? Yep, okay. No one was injured. They just rolled. It was a dynamic roll. Everyone was fine. And so then we, not me and my team, they had another alert crew ready with pilots, air crew, and pararescue men to go up there and do that mission.
Okay.
Those people. What ended up happening? This is 2010. So what ended up happening was they couldn't get in there on the helicopter again. And so the next PJs that were on alert this particular day, they got dropped off at the bottom of the glacier and they skied up in the snowstorm to the site. And then they got there in a snowstorm and a whiteout, and they, I forget how long of an overland on skis it was, roped up. They get there and they stabilize everyone, got everyone warm again. And then when the weather broke, maybe a day or two later, the helicopters got in there and took everyone out.
And so you all really do have to do some serious prolonged field care with really limited supplies, what's in your backpack. In really critical situations. Those are some good skills to have. Those are the people you want with you in any situation.
For sure.
And so you do all of these intense activities. Is there anything that actually scares you? Like, are you afraid of spiders or snakes or anything?
Things do scare me. Like I worry about my kids a lot. I don't want them to get hurt. That's and my wife, and I do worry about that. And it's when I let my kids go and do things, it does scare me, because they both are kind of
like you.
Do crazy things. I guess one thing that makes my palms sweat these days is when I'm flying and it's very turbulent and I'm at the limits of what the plane can, handle. So getting bounced around.
Do you have
around,
any warnings?
Pushed around.
Yeah. Yep. And you have small planes, correct? These are like Cessnas?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I have a Super Cub, a Piper Super Cub, and a Cessna 180.
Okay. Is it like a weather report? Is there a warning of turbulence ever? When you kind of know it's going to happen, or does it just come out of nowhere?
No, sometimes there's clear air turbulence that you never know when it's going to come out. But yes, it is often very forecastable. Sometimes, like when we go out into the far reaches of the state to go hunting or climbing or camping or whatever, you don't have access to those services. And so I can solicit some of that through an in-reach text here and there, but it's not always accurate. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are crashing planes up here so often.
Well, there was a weird, I don't know if you and Alex talked about it, but for our viewers, we have a common friend, Alex Jones, but there were like six planes that went down inside of 2 hours around Alaska, and one of them was one of our friends. He's okay, but it was just, it was kind of weird, because then it's like, well, was it like a EMP, or was it just odd luck, or, you know, what happened that made so many planes go down in such a short amount of time?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of factors. For instance, Mary Peltola, I don't know if you're familiar with Mary Peltola.
Yes.
She's,
yes.
Yep. She's one of our representatives in Washington, D.C., and her husband just passed in a plane crash during hunting season.
Yes.
This year. And I just read a report today from the NTSB that he had quite a load on that he was flying out. And then there was a little bit of tumultuous winds on the departure end of where the dirt where he was taken off from.
That makes me so sad, because she's just such a lovely human being, and they just looked so happy, and it was just really nice to see him championing her through all this.
Mm-hmm.
And our hearts at World Extreme Medicine go out to her and her whole family.
Yeah.
So we'll switch gears a little bit. So what is something that, as a rescuer, you wish the everyday hiker heading into the backcountry carried in their pack? Or some things. It could be a few things.
I think what keeps your pack light, and which is important, is knowledge. Knowledge and how to use things and make the right decisions, so you're not getting hurt. Accidents do happen, of course, but if you're going to have some things, make sure you have some training and know how to deal with some basic things, and some things that are going to help with those basic life-saving things are like a cravat that you can make a bandage with, or you can make a tourniquet with. You want to put things in your backpack that do multiple things. They have more than one use. So I guess with that, a cravat would be one thing, and you can make a tourniquet with it, making a windlass. Additionally, a survival blanket is very important, because when you do finally get control of the bleeding, you have to worry about the coagulopathy and things like the patient warm. Is really, really important, even in the desert scenarios. Duct tape is a great thing to have that you can make it with. I wouldn't take this, and I wouldn't advise someone to take it if they don't have the right training, but a 14 gauge 3 to decompress along if you need to, because that's an airway, like it's a quick life saving thing that's gonna help you to the next steps.
And it's a lot kinder than a dirty knife and a finger thoracotomy.
Yeah.
A needle decompression.
Yeah, and in that case, those people, if they do need a needle, they are going to buy a tube, right? I think that's.
But you can buy them time with that.
You can buy them time. Yeah.
So after all this,
I think that's it.
Oh yeah. That's a good list. I like that list.
Yeah. One other thing that it seems like I have with everything that you keep your skis together with. I don't know. They're like Bollé straps is what they call them.
Yes.
but you can kind of keep all that stuff together with the Bollé strap, and then that Bollé strap has its use. So you're going to use it to make part of a litter or whatever. And if everyone has the same stuff, then you have a couple of straps to make your litter. You know what I mean?
I like that. And that I'm going to add that to my kit. I'm definitely adding that to my kit. So after all of this, jumping out of planes, living on Denali for months at a time, after all this, you decide it's time to slow it down a little. But you don't seem like a person to sit idle, and you joined the Anchorage Fire Department as a firefighter paramedic, which for many people is not at all slow and might be the most gung-ho that they go. And so what made you want to experience ground EMS?
You know, the training that we got to get our paramedic, you go do your longs and you get some experience, but at the end of the day, you're not a real street medic. There's a lot more involved to being a street medic than there was to being a trombat. And, so it just seemed like a logical next step for me. In fact, I was actually going to go to PA school, but life got a hold of me and I'm actually glad that I went to the fire department, because it was a good challenge, and it was really the people that I worked with. That's really important to any workplace, to any job satisfaction. So I'm happy that I did that, and to get the change and get an experience, another base of experience that I didn't have.
And so even Anchorage is pretty vast. Like, Alaska's vast and Anchorage as a city is vast. excuse me. Is there ever a challenge of, we can't go fast enough? You know, I wish I could just jump out of a plane and get there already.
It's like you're racing all over town here. For sure. But you know, we just like,
and any, do you ever collaborate, like meet up with the air crews?
Oh, with the air guard out there. The only time that we would with them is if they brought in someone on their C-130, and we would bring them their C-130 at the base and put them in the ambulance and bring them to the hospital, because they don't have that capability. That's one situation. Another situation is coordinating mud rescue. You know, right here in Anchorage, the tide goes out, and there are big people go out and walk in the mud and get stuck in the mud and can't get out. And so sometimes we'll coordinate with them to go and help those people, or sometimes there'll be when the tide does come in, there are boats out there. They'll coordinate to someone that's in a disabled boat out in Cook Inlet. That's the extent of the interaction between the guard and the Anchorage Fire Department.
Being stuck out in that mud with that tide coming in is, I've watched that tide come in. I mean, that, it doesn't happen very slowly. It comes in fairly quickly in some places, and it just seems quite terrifying. How often does that happen, that people hike out there and get stuck in the mud?
Yearly, multiple times a year. And I don't quote me on how often people die every year, every other year or so. There was someone, was it this year or this last year, they were on their honeymoon and the guy got caught. And
no one could reach him in time, and he drowned.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's horrible. Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry. That is horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible.
So then what comes after the fire department?
Although I did enjoy working at the fire department and working with the people, and I love the leadership, and a guy that I ski with and fly with Like we have skis for our planes and we go fly into the mountains and ski. And he was a pilot for Guardian Flight and ops wanting to have more time to go and ski and such and play in the mountains. But he sent me a note one day saying that the medic crews are going to be changing their schedule. And it might be something that you want to consider, a bunch of people. And so in the beginning, I was like, well, I make a good paycheck and bad, even though I'm tired often from being up all night. I think it'll be okay. But I got to talking with my wife about it, and she's like, why don't you just put your name in the hat and see if they want to interview you, something that would work out. And so here we are. And at the end of the day, I think things are meant to be. I do think this is a new challenging phase in medicine for me. Like I've never had to deal with these T1 vent Hamilton ventilators and pumps, IV pumps, and the myriad of drugs that we have that we didn't have at the Anchorage Fire Department because it's much longer prolonged care. So it's been a nice move.
And have you ever seen the northern lights from any of your planes during, like, during a call or just in general up
Oh
in
yeah.
Alaska?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. It's pretty magical. It's been nice and
It
clear lately, and
is.
they've been active.
Oh, that's
Have you time
great.
up here?
I have. So I have seen them once in Alaska. Because they didn't always happen down out in the Aleutians where we were. We were kind of further down the chain and we were often outside kind of the zone. But I've seen them in northern Wisconsin twice and in Minnesota once and Alaska once. And it just every time you just stand there just with jaw
Yeah.
on the ground because it's so beautiful and it's just surreal.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen anything that you would qual classify as a unidentified flying object?
No, I don't think so. Although when I was a combat, okay, so when I was a combat controller, we would do a lot of our training, calling an airstrike type training. It's called Joint Special Tactics Air Control or JTAC training in Gila Bend, New Mexico. And so you're out there in the middle of the night calling airstrikes and mock targets, and they drop flares, these planes that will illuminate the sky. Sometimes, yeah, and so and I the neighboring town of Gila Bend, they would often say like this is where it's come, but they don't realize that these fighter planes are dropped. So no, I have not seen what I would think is a UFO, but it's kind of funny that that was
That.
a phenomenon down there.
Yes, that makes sense. That makes sense. So what advice would you have for a young medic who looks at this incredibly diverse portfolio career you've had? You've been able to climb mountains, you've been able to be a military hero, you've been able to skydive out of airplanes into critical patients. And so what advice would you have for a young medic who looks at you and says, I want to do that. I want to be that guy. Like how do I get there? How do they start themselves on this path?
I think first and foremost, a lot of people get into this type of work, and they may not have a sincere desire to help. It's the number one thing that you have to begin with, to help to the desire to help people, or to be able to work as a team together. Is really, really important, whether it's your team or someone that you ran into that you're and then they're already there, or they come to help you. It's important to be a good team player. But as far as going down the road, that they really have changed the construct of the selection process, and I'm not really sure what it entails these days because it has just changed. Until when I went through it, it was in basic training. I had to take a pass test, which was a swim and a run and some calisthenics. And you win the door to go through the indoctrination course. I'm quite sure that there is still an indoctrination course, and that's like the selection. And it was 10 weeks of group of benchmarks that you had to meet each week and a bunch of different modalities. And then if you made it through that, then you would go into the pipeline of training. So I guess if you are going to pirate rescue in the Air Force, then you have to have like the no quit ethos in you.
You said something interesting to me. You said like no bad attitudes. You know, you have to bring the right attitude to it, and the will makes the way.
Yeah, where there's a will, there's a way. And if you have a bad attitude and you're going to point the finger at someone else, it's just not going to work out for you. It's just not.
Definitely not in the SEALs.
Yeah. You know, we did here in Alaska, and we won. And oftentimes I would think about like why we would, one of the reasons we would win is the home court advantage. But number two is the people that were on our team. They're just happy, willing to get the job done, willing to pump and prop your partners up, starting to fall back or feel down.
Yep. And you put in your time too. You know, you didn't just snap your fingers and I'm a paramedic jumping out of a plane. You know, you put in 6 years of active duty, setting up communications, and you know, you put in your time. So I would advise young people to don't be afraid to put in the time. If you want to be a doctor, you have to go to 4 years of medical school.
Yeah. You have to put
Any last words of wisdom for our listeners before we bid them goodbye?
I don't think so. I think, just do it for the right reason. The path that you want to take. It's been extremely rewarding for me. I don't think that I would have changed any chapters of my life with regard to my job choices. Always strive to better yourself, and that's another reason why I went to the fire department. I'm doing this, like I need to change it, refresh, challenge yourself even at 50 years old.
Paramedic John Davis, thank you very much for spending time with me this evening, and thank you again to everyone listening. I'm Dr. Sarah Spelsberg, and it is my pleasure to share these extreme medicine adventures with you. And if you're listening with us, you too are an extreme medic, and we welcome you to the World Extreme Medicine family. So stay safe out there and always keep pushing your boundaries.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.